And now, join Kevin Hart as he dives into the minds of some of your favorite celebrities. This is Gold Mines with Kevin Hart.
Welcome world. You already know what it is. It's another episode of Gold Mines. You know what we do here. I feel like saying it is now a disadvantage because I know you know, but I just like to reiterate it just to double down on it because there's so much understanding that goes into the great detail that this podcast provides. This is a podcast where we get inside the minds of amazing people, amazing talent, amazing individuals with journeys that I feel are best told through this platform because there's so much that you can take away, right? Gems aren't gems unless people grab and like take a hold of them and really put good use behind them. In this case, I feel like all of the people that we've had on this podcast have given us a great opportunity to do that. Today will be no different, world, because we have another great mind. Another great mind. I got to say somebody that I'm not only a fan of, but somebody that I have such a tremendous amount of respect for because of their work, because of their ambition, because of what they're inspired by, and because of their through line to success. When you really get engaged and you really start to understand and you look deep, you find out some deep stuff. And with this guy, I found out a lot, and I can't wait for you guys to find out. Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to welcome F. Gary Gray to Gold Mines. Put your hands together. Come on, F. Come on, man. How are you, sir? You look great. You look great. What's this? You brought a gift for me.
I did.
This may be my first gift on Gold Mines. I've never got a gift.
Oh, really?
This is
okay,
the first one.
Yeah.
No, you want me to open it here?
Yeah, just open it. It's simple.
Is it embarrassing? Like, if people see it, they can be like, that's what he got him?
It depends. No,
okay.
No.
All right.
No, it's gold, though.
Okay.
Gold
Hold
Mines.
On. Hold on.
Hold we on. We did a movie about a gold heist.
Hold on, man.
And,
Hold on. To our listeners, so far, I opened it up. There was gold packaging around it. It's now a leather case. Leather case seems like it's providing that. You know what? You see, you're just a classy motherfucker.
Hey, listen.
You're just a classy guy,
hey,
bro.
Listen.
You're just
listen.
A classy guy, man.
More Gold Mines with Kevin Hart after this.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Now more from Kevin Hart on Gold Mines.
This is something that we need to celebrate.
We
did our thing. We went through it. We're done. We're finished. And I just want to share a cigar with you, bro, because, you know, and those are special cigars.
Well, you're a special person just because of the way you think. For my listeners, he just told you what it was. It was a leather case filled with cigars. I got about four very nice cigars. And when you talk about celebration, you can't celebrate unless there's great reason to. I feel like we definitely do have great reason to celebrate. I know that we basically have about 8 days before our movie does drop. But there was a lot of great detail that went into this movie. There was a lot of great conversation that you and I had before you know, you decided to actually take on the movie. It was
right. Seeing
where my mind was, seeing how I wanted to approach the movie. And I think once you saw how serious I was about the project and how desperate I was about attaching myself to the talent of you, because I wanted you to tell this story correctly and give me the visuals that I've yet to have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you beat those conversations up and making sure that you were secure in my commitment to the project. And I think, to date, we know that we got that, but I think in return, I know that I got it as well. And when you talk about celebrating, we're celebrating the complete process
right. That
you and I know that we embarked on, which is dope as hell. And I like that you didn't lie to me, man. You didn't lie to me.
How so?
You didn't lie to me. Like, you know, when I came to you and talked to you, you know, I was talking about The Legend. And for those who do not know about The Legend of F. Gary Gray, let me just give you a quick background, right? You're talking about a guy who came from the world of video directing from California, okay? This guy is L.A. to the bone. You're talking about Friday. You're talking about Straight Outta Compton. We're talking about Italian Job. We're talking about a member of the Fast and Furious franchise. But you're talking about a guy whose creativity has not only attached itself to these amazing projects, but to amazing talent, right?
Mm.
Like, if we really want to dig into it, and you and I were just talking backstage, like, the talent that you've been able to work with in the beginning stage that has went on to do remarkable things in their career. Chris Tucker, we talked about Queen Latifah. You know, we talked about Mos Def at one point. There's mm-hmm. there's a nice cultural attachment of F. Gary Gay to the culture. And right. even from the music videos of old mm-hmm. that had some of the biggest visuals. I mean, TLC and what you did with that video. F. Gary Gray's creative mind attached to the projects that he's really given his energy, time, and love to are now evergreen, right? And talking about that,
thank you.
How does that make you feel, knowing that F. Gary Gray is a cultural like legend, and now a legend in the mainstream world as well, because your box office revenue is generated over, what, $1 billion now?
$2 billion.
$2 billion? You're proud of yourself? You see how you're proud of yourself? Yeah. Let's get into your feeling. How does that make you feel now when you get to look back on all the work that you've done and you see the success that you stand on?
How does it make me feel? I don't think about it much. I'm always focused on the future, and I don't know if that's a good thing or not. I was forced to kind of look back for this podcast because I knew you were going to talk about some of the work from the past, but it feels good to be able to look back and see a lot of the talent going to do big things.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of brought it up that I work with some, you know, great talents at the beginning of their journeys in this entertainment business, and it's great to see them just thrive, man. I love the challenge of transitions, kind of similar to what you did here, but with Chris Tucker, he was a stand-up comedian,
mm-hmm.
and I think he had a line or two in a movie before, but him transitioning from stand-up comedian to bona fide movie star was, you know, with Friday. And so I was happy to be a part of that. We're all kids. Same with Queen Latifah. You know, she was obviously a music icon at that point, and she did some television, but her first leading role was in Set It Off.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and I can just go down the list of people I've had the great fortune of working with who were making transitions. And that's just all part of it and how I feel about it. It feels great, but I just don't spend a lot of time thinking about it.
You don't?
No, because I love to learn. I love to learn. I'm an avid reader. I'm a student, and so I don't spend a lot of time celebrating because I just feel like there's so much I need to know and I need to learn. And you know, when I think about it, I think it kind of stems from insecurity I had when I was younger because I didn't have the resources to go to college or film school. And so a lot of, you know, my peers, you know, they went to NYU or USC, and I just didn't have the resources at the time. And so I took a different route to film, and it was just very hands-on. So I never lost that need to learn. And so when I'm doing movies and picking movies, part of it is learning. And so I don't spend a lot of time thinking about the past.
I want to go back to that. I mean, when you talk about like not having the resources that a lot of your peers had, right? And the resources, yeah. of course, is the opportunity for education, the alignment that education brings, and what can happen after you have those credentials under your belt, right?
Sure.
You go in a different way. You go into the scrap and scrape, the scrap and scrape, you know, guerrilla way, if you want to say. When was it that you knew, you know what, my career, my opportunities are going to come from film, from my visibility behind the lens? I think that I am destined to be a guy to make things better from a visual perspective. When did you get that realization?
Probably 16.
Okay.
At 16, I realized that I had I had people who responded to some of the stuff that I was creating in high school. I moved from South Central LA, where I grew up, to Highland Park, Illinois. And I always kind of tell this story about how where I lived, and I was talking to my mother the other day, she said, we grew up in the hood, not the hood, but mm-hmm. the hood, capital T-H-E, and it was kind of like growing up in a Hughes Brothers movie. You know, they did Men's Society. And then I went to complete high school in Illinois in the suburbs, which was like a John Hughes movie. You remember Breakfast Club and 16 Candles. So it was two different background. And when I went there, I started to kind of work in there. They had a television class called Giants in Action, and I did camera work, and I directed and edited and things like that. And that's when I knew this is something I could do. And people responded to it. So that's when I decided to become a director.
And where were the resources coming from? Like when you said you had to scrap and scrape, you know, you had to figure it out.
Sure.
At that point, what was the hustle attached to figuring it out? What were you compiling to basically make the opportunities that they were? What is it that you were gathering?
Well, first of all, the hustle came from the streets.
Yeah.
You know, growing up in South Central LA, it was beautiful. It was also dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in that environment, you have to learn how to just survive. You also have to be creative. When you're broke and you have a lot of money and you're on welfare and things like that, you don't get all the, you know, newest toys during Christmas. You don't just get all the things that you admire that's being marketed to you as a child. You want them, but you don't have them. And I remember growing up, my mother would buy me those little boxes of Legos where you can build the little car. Not the big Star Wars one where you had the Millennium Falcon and things like that, but the little boxes of Legos, and I never made what was on the box. I would just take those little boxes, which we could afford those, and throw them in a suitcase. And anything I saw on television, I would go into the suitcase and build it.
Wow.
And so growing up in that environment helped me to create and just be creative. You know, never had the money to get the new bike, so I would just take parts from all my different friends' bikes and things like that and build a bike. And you know, it's just like filmmaking. You know, you don't have enough time, you don't have enough money, you got to be creative, you got to figure it out.
So
I started my filmmaking journey before I even knew about film.
You know, it's funny when you say build the shit that you don't have. I remember we had these little Hugs, right? There were these juice boxes that we had when I came up in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
And they had just came out with this bike called the Sonic 6, which made like the motorcycle noise. My mom wouldn't get it for me. My dad couldn't because my dad was in jail at the time. And I took a Hug bottle and I figured out that the Hug bottle made the motorcycle noise. So I put the Hug bottle underneath my back tire, like where the brakes was.
Right.
And I rode with my friends that had the Sonic 6. And for a while, they thought I had the Sonic 6.
Right.
Kev got one too. And then they were like, what's that in the back? What's
the
that
Sonic
with your
4.
Back wheel? Like, that's what the noise coming from that makes me feel like I got what y'all got.
Right.
But coming up in that environment, it was okay. It was something that we all accepted, right? Like if you didn't have, you did your best to create the closest thing to it. And that creative engine sparks the world of creativity that doesn't stop, right?
Exactly.
Where did the first opportunity, what was the first big break and your directing opportunity, right? We're talking about being 16. Now that, of course, we're talking about getting older and saying, okay, well, how am I going to do this? In your mind, what was the first thing that acted as your defining moment to say, I'm going to be a director?
Well, it started, I started off kind of as a cameraman. And like I said, you get that hustle from the streets. And I created a resume. And I had all these projects from high school, and I just took high school off of my resume and went to this. I know. Hey, listen, you had to do what you had to do. You don't have a degree, you better figure it out, right? So
yeah, I did.
I
walking to the moon. You guys ever see that? Well, I did that. That's one of mine. Yeah, just a list.
Hey,
of
listen,
yeah.
It's a list.
Yeah,
I didn't
I
lie.
It.
I just left out high school.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just remember my first big break as a cameraman. I was 19 years old. And I submitted this impressive resume. And I remember going into this production space where they had maybe 8 cameramen. Everyone's wearing black. They had all these massive cameras laying on the floor with all this equipment. And it's one thing if you studied on high school equipment.
Yeah.
That's one thing.
Yeah.
I walked into space and they had all this new equipment, high-tech stuff, Sony cameras, kind of similar to this stuff here, and I had no idea how to use it.
Shit.
And I just remember this guy, he was a good guy in hindsight. I think he knew I was full of shit. He just kind of... I walked in, I had on all black, and he said, I know you already know about this button. This turns it on. And this does the white balance. I'm like, sure, of course I do. And then he says, and you know that this does this and this does that. And he kind of just by default kind of walked me through how to do this because he saw that I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
they ended up putting me on stage as camera number one. Now, they had 7 other choices,
yeah,
but they put me on stage similar to this, and there was a big musical performance, and I just start doing all these crazy camera moves and things like that, and they kept saying, cut back to camera one, cut back to camera one, cut back to camera one. And that was one of my first big breaks, because after that, they loved kind of some of the weird stuff I was doing. Mm-hmm. It was kind of new to them, mm-hmm, and creative, and they just kept hiring me over and over again. And then because I was successful in that field, I was able to save up enough money to do a short film.
Okay.
Or at least most of the money. And so most people think that I come out of music videos and then decided to do film, but the opposite is true.
Okay.
I decided to make film when I was 16, but only had access to television equipment. And I made a short film called Divided We Fall.
Okay.
It was a drama. And, you know, if you see my movies, if you look closely, there's a common theme that runs through them, and it's bringing people together.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't able to finish it. I didn't have the money to finish it. And so I started doing music videos to help fund finishing this short film.
Mm-hmm.
And I would show the trailer to all these artists and everyone who would listen to help me finish this thing. I literally wrote letters to the CEO of Kodak, the CEO of Panavision.
Hustle.
And the hustle, this exactly. Hustle. And I was like, could you help me make my short film? This is about the community. Can you do this thing? And they let me use all their equipment. And back in the day, those cameras, the film cameras, like $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
We had Aluma cranes and things like that. And so I was able to shoot part of it. And then I ran out of money. And I did a music video with Dub C and Ice Cube.
Mm-hmm.
And
which of course had a relationship with Ice Cube started.
That's how it started. Mm-hmm. Did a few music videos with him. And then one day he was like, why don't we do a feature length picture? And I'm like, yeah, of course. This is what I'm doing a short film for. And that's how Friday came about.
You know, it's amazing how dots connect that you don't see. Right? Like, you're talking about the scrap and scrape mindset attached to, okay, well, you know, I'm making money from this opportunity as a cameraman, but my bigger vision is attached to directing. I got this story, I got this script, I'm going to do this to do this, and mm-hmm, then it has to be a pause. I got to pause because I don't have the money, but I don't not want to do it right, so I got to find a way to make the money. Holy shit, opportunity comes up to direct the video. You don't even see the opportunity being attached to this other creative mind whose want is attached to doing things in the film business. His want is to go and take his talent of writing and his creativity attached to funny and bring it to the big screen somehow, and two young, hungry minds connect at a bottom level where they go, fuck it. What was the fuck it? What was the, okay, we're going to do it, how are we going to do it? Like, was there a game plan at first? Was Cube somewhat connected a little bit? Like, how did the Friday, like, what was the real birth of it? Because, of course, we know that there was a script. We know there's an idea.
There was no script.
There was no script. So Cube didn't even have the script done.
No.
It was just an idea.
No. He was on tour.
Okay.
And I think that, he was one of the guys that I went to help with this short film.
Mm-hmm.
And we had experienced success with the music video, It Was a Good Day.
Okay.
And that was kind of a short film in itself.
Absolutely.
You know, today was a good day. It was like a day in the life. And I was able to kind of, you know, learn a little more about some of the technical side of shooting and, you know, working with a massive crew and helicopters and police and all this type of stuff. But how that came about is he gave me a call and he was like, you know, Robert Townsend just did a film on credit cards and begged, borrowed, and stealed to do this. And I think also there was another film that someone did on a shoestring budget, and he said, I know you want to make a feature film, and I wasn't even thinking about a comedy, because I was thinking about, you know, what change can I bring to my community? That's what Divided We Fall was about. And he says, I want to do a comedy, and we can do it in the neighborhood. Cube grew up like a few miles away from me, and we can do it in the neighborhood. And I was like, okay, let's try that. And I was 23 years old,
mm-hmm.
and he knew, just like with the music videos, that I was really technically advanced, but I also knew the culture. And that was very rare to have someone who knew the culture,
mm-hmm.
and knew the hood, mm-hmm. and knew kind of what was authentic about being in that space, but also technically knew what they were doing. Because I think the music video director for Strata Compton was British. And so there weren't like brothers actually directing back
then. They didn't know. All your money up and hold it in your fist like this. That's not, no, you can't.
Right.
That's not how
it works.
And
I'm going to take anything away from it, but there was just something more that they would get from working with me. They, mm-hmm. I would never pay myself. I would always take my director's fee and put it into production. Mm-hmm. And so instead of shooting 16 millimeter, we would shoot 35 millimeter. We would have helicopters. I would give them something that felt more cinematic,
mm-hmm.
than just kind of like guys standing in front of a camera and rapping to a camera. It's like, how can I bring meaning even ever so slightly? Like, today was a good day. I didn't just do it because it was a music video. It was the meaning behind it. It's like, today I didn't even have to use my AK. I had to say it was a good day. It was like the day he didn't have problems with the police, the day he didn't have to resort to gun violence, that meant something to me.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at Friday, even though comedy wasn't the genre that I gravitated to, I love comedies, but who knew if I could do it? When you look at that movie, we maybe not so elegantly focused on gun violence too. You know, put the guns down, maybe fight it out so you can live, mm-hmm. to fight another day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That wasn't in the original script. That's something I took from Divided We Fall and injected into Friday.
Mm-hmm.
So it had some meaning. And you'll see that with Strata Compton as well. They came to me to actually do that movie, and I said no initially because I was just like, I don't want to make Strata Compton because it could turn out like CB4. It's like dudes with Jerry Curl wigs and, you know.
Yeah.
How do I
tap into the art of it? How do I tap into the depth of the story?
Yeah, it's just something with meaning. I told them, hey, listen, you know, this movie is much bigger than the group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can make a kind of a video or a movie about kind of foul mouth kids and low riders and, you know, women dancing in front of the camera, but I'm not interested in that. I said, you know, I wanted to understand the why a 16-year-old would write those lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
If we can get to the why, then that's something I would do.
Mm-hmm.
So I know you were asking about Friday, but that came about, I was 23 years old. I read the script. He was sending me pages from the road when he was on tour, and I was like, oh, this is good, this is cool, this is funny. I imagined it in the hood I grew up in. So we shot it on my block where I grew up. So Craig's house was my friend Chris Tyson's house. And where...
How many favors? How many neighborhood favors?
Oh, you know, that's an interesting question.
Why are you so shocked that I would have an interesting question? Like, what was that?
Because, man, you've been living a good life for so long. I don't know, bro.
What the fuck was that? Did you just see that? Wow, Kev.
You've been living a good life for a long time.
That's an interesting question,
bro.
Kevin.
I do remember going to the neighborhood. I'll just call it the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And speaking to about 40 guys. We all went up to the junior high school. And I said, we're shooting here. And we don't want any trouble.
Yeah, yeah.
And these guys I grew up with, and they said, yeah, you of course, you have a pass, and we'll keep this place safe, and you won't have any issues.
Yeah.
And so they kept that whole set protected until we stopped shooting.
Yes.
And then, like, the moment we stopped shooting, it was popping again. It was popping.
But you know what's crazy? I mean, that's also a decision that I feel like, you know, the hood doesn't get enough, they don't get a lot of light for the understanding of who we're choosing and backing to represent us and to go further, right? And when that choice is made, whether it's the athletic talent that is flourishing, whether it's your academic talent that's in the hood, they're identified early on as your possible stars that can go above and beyond. And the choice to keep them out of the shit or keep the shit away from them, it really is like a well-thought-out choice. I wish I could say that the involvement, my involvement in the hood was significant, but it was my brother that put in all the work, and I was the one that was given the passes to go to school and go to the Northeast and hopefully become or do. I was on the swim team, et cetera.
Right.
And it was accepted. I was still cool and they still loved me, but I never had to partake in the dumb shit. And they really did do a good job of keeping the dumb shit away from me. So when you say having that conversation, not many can have that conversation.
No.
That's a real testament to who you were at the time and to how they saw you. To say, no, we got it. We'll make sure that you're good so you can finish the project.
Right.
And literally in doing that, to have the security that we're okay and everybody's fine, that's a big fucking deal.
It's a big deal.
That's a big deal.
It's definitely a big deal. And I give props to them because, like I said, they made it really safe. And to this day, it's funny. They, you know, the Hollywood tours where they take people on the bus and they go. So they go back to my neighborhood and they take pictures of Craig's house. And even my house where I grew up, because, you know, the scene where they had Tiny Lister who played Debo.
Yeah.
And they had that moment where I think he's, you know, DJ Pooh gets knocked down. He's like, "You got knocked the fuck out." That was my house.
Right there
where I
house.
Grew up,
where
right in front of my house.
Yeah.
And so that little area is now famous because of the decision they made to let us do it there.
Well, I mean, look, there's a lot of things that are famous that are attached to Friday. I think the biggest thing that you tapped in, though, the biggest thing that you tapped on, of course, was the story and then the underlying definitions that some would miss, right? Like when you're talking about use your hands, you're talking about the concept of live to see another day.
Yes.
You are basically dealing with people who are using their creative resources to put out different feelings or messages of positivity.
Right.
With that, it becomes received. It becomes a hood classic. Holy shit. F. Gary Gray is attached to a movie that's now went on to create crazy conversations in multiple different, you know, hoods across the world that relate, that understand.
Sure.
But from this, will more opportunities come? At this point, what I want to know is there a fear that was attached to taking on the next possible project? Because right now, there's a good conversation attached to you. So when it comes, of course, the opportunity changes because the number attached to the project, your responsibility in handling and operating that money.
Sure.
When was there a point, or if there was a point, of possible fear of, I can't fuck this up. Am I in a position to do this correctly? Or am I okay with figuring out as I go on, as I've done since I've basically been doing it to get to this stage?
The fear came just with making Friday because we only had 20 days to shoot it. We had 4 or 5 day periods, and that was it.
That's it.
And we had the threat of me being fired if I went over budget or over schedule.
What was the budget? What was y'all budget for Friday?
$1 million.
$1 million.
Yes.
20 days, $1 million.
20 days, $1 million, and it was, they wrote it up as one of the most profitable movies in 1995.
1,000%.
Yeah. So the return on the investment, which I know you know a lot about.
ROI.
It was great. Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. There's no ROI. Right.
The ROI was popping. But we had no idea that it was going to do that, honestly. Mm-hmm. I hear these, I've gone on YouTube and seen Chris Tucker tell the story about how he and Faison Love watched the first cut and they thought their careers were over. And they were like, oh, this is not working. And then I thought, damn, my career's over before it even started.
It's a triple effect.
Yeah, no, there was no fear for the next one, which was Set It Off. That movie...
You're confident going into it?
I'm confident because...
More Gold Mines with Kevin Hart after this.
Hey, world, what's going on? Kevin Hart here, and I've got something huge to kick off your new year. Get ready for Lift. The heist movie of the year is going to take you all the way up to 40,000 feet. In the movie, I play Cyrus Whitaker, a master thief with an incredible international crew who is racing against time to snatch $500 million in gold from a passenger plane. Yes, you heard it right, a flying plane. This is directed by the legendary F. Gary Gray, who brought us the classic thriller, The Italian Job. Lyft has everything you love in a heist film. We've got the tactics to the bad guys, the gadgets, and the stakes that are higher than you've ever seen. And I do mean that literally. Join me in a star-studded cast with Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Ursula Cabero, and Vincent D'Onofrio. Guys, we got many more amazing actors and actresses in this movie. Trust me, this is a film that you do not want to miss. And guys, I got to be honest, you get to see a different side of me, the savant, the mastermind, while also giving you guys the humor and heart and action that I know you need. Buckle up. Prepare, guys, because we got a thrilling ride coming your way with Lyft, only on Netflix, January 12th.
We return to Gold Mines, hosted by Kevin Hart.
I'd always knew that I could tell different stories and different genres. Spielberg was one of my inspirations. And, you know, I watched a lot of his movies coming up. And he just kind of bounced around different genres and things like that. And that was an inspiration. So I didn't have any representation when I did Friday. And so a lot of the agencies were looking to represent me. And I said, well, whoever can bring me an action film, a more serious film, that's who could represent me. And I'm trying to remember at the time. I think it was ICM. ICM at the time came with Set It Off. And I picked it up right away, got the movie right away, went straight into production.
Wow. By the way, great use of snaps.
Thank you.
No, I'm serious.
Thank
like,
you.
I've never you. Fucking seen
yeah, just
a more right on a
snappier
punctuated
snap.
Fuck.
Yeah,
hey,
I'm on
F,
it.
When I say that shit
hey,
at
listen.
Me, I don't. Yeah, I got
yeah,
a little
right.
snap. Set the door and go, bow. Did this. Bow.
Wake up.
Like, fuck yeah, you
wake
did.
Up.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah, you did.
That's right.
So,
oh, and that's funny. At some point, we'll get into this. But you know how I direct is in flow. You know how they had those conversations about sports stars who get into flow. And, you know, for instance, if you play basketball, they say sometimes the hoop feels like it's the size of a swimming pool.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm into rhythm. That's my film school.
Mm-hmm.
Earth, Wind, and Fire, though, my professors. And so when you say the snap got you going,
yeah.
you know what it took me to our process, because you're connected as well. And there will be times where I would do just gestures. I didn't have to go into this big Shakespearean conversation about motivation to get you going for this role. I would do gestures and hands and do this and that, and you would be right on the same frequency
mm-hmm.
and you would make the adjustment. So sorry I went off on a tangent, but those snaps mean something.
No.
It woke your ass
it's
up.
It's no tangent. It's all connectivity. I like the great use of what it did and what it meant, right? And before we go into like
yeah.
the rapport that you and I that we had, that we built,
yes.
that we discovered,
yeah.
I want to keep telling the story and just give people an opportunity just to understand, like, you know, the journey. And I stand on
yes.
this. Every time we do this podcast, and I have guests on here, I'm more about someone's journey than I am about the highlighting of the success today.
Like, sure.
We can all see what the bells and whistles that are attached today are.
Sure.
Are attached to today. But understanding the journey, when you hear the scrape, the hustle, I didn't know. I was there. I said, fuck it. I'm going to figure it out. I didn't know how to use these cameras. Somebody gave me a quick run over, but I said, all right, let me go and do some creative shit with the camera that I just feel they may respond to. And then in responding, it landed me this opportunity. I met this guy. This guy ended up becoming a close friend. We shot this video. I took my money. I put it back in the video. I didn't receive profit. What you're listening to somebody that's determined on getting to the end result. And whatever it takes to get to the end result, I'm committed to doing, because I'm that confident in what I know I can do.
Mm.
That's the understanding that I'm taking away, and that's what I'm loving. And now as we talk
sure.
about Set It Off, and you're like, look, I said the first agent that can bring me said thing, that's action, that gives me another like another piece of like oomph to sink my teeth into from a
sure.
creative space, that's who I'll go with. You get this thing. You do it. What was the budget for Set It Off?
$9 million.
$9 million. That's a fucking big jump at this time. We're in what year? What year were you in?
This was 96?
96.
96, yeah.
So you're now in business with the studio. A studio now
yeah.
saw the work that you did. There's a return attached on the movie. Of course, it didn't reach the numbers that it did later on because it just kept growing and building and building.
Mm-hmm.
But now we go, okay, we feel that this guy is capable of taking a $9 million budget, delivering this film in how long? What was the time of the shoot?
39 days.
39 days. A big jump from the 20 that you had?
Yes. It depends on how you look at it. Okay. You got to remember, Friday was shot on a porch.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's one thing to shoot on a porch for 20 days. It was hard. But when you have multiple action sequences, like, for instance, with Set It Off, we locked down Wilshire Boulevard. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't know if you remember.
I remember this whole movie like the back of my hand.
There's a sequence where...
Sorry, I felt it was
I'm not
going
to live that down. Go ahead. I won't live that down. No, there was a sequence that we locked down Wilshire Boulevard where they're robbing a bank and Queen Latifah comes and saves the day where she, you know, blasts through with a Suburban, mm-hmm. rushes into mm-hmm. the bank, you know, grabs the crew and then smashes onto Wilshire Boulevard. And we only had one take to do that.
Wow.
And so normally... with an action film that has that much action and gunfire and stunts. And as you know, everything that we put into it, it takes longer. So on a normal budget with a normal schedule, that would have been a 60-day schedule. Mm-hmm. But we did it in 39. And, you know, one take for this, one take for that. Some of the approach in terms of the shots and things like that were dictated not just by creativity, but just by necessity. You only have one take to do this scene. And I have, you know, four actors that I have to cover. So yeah. I have to be really creative about getting that coverage. So Set It Off was, it was a great experience, but it was tough as well.
Well, right now, the segue that I'm getting to is the transition from the guy that was just behind the camera to understanding the camera to the guy that's now communicating with talent.
Yes.
Right? And, you know, from Friday, of course, you're communicating, and that's with comedic talent. You started off doing your first film, and that was more of a drama. But now the talent sure. and your role that you're playing with the talent, well, it's extremely valuable, right? So
yes.
So at this point, under the pressure, wow. needing to get everything in the timeline that you need to get it to, how did you feel about the way that you were communicating with your actors and actresses at that point?
Awful.
Yeah.
Awful. How'd you know that, though?
I'm great at what I do.
That's it.
You see what I'm saying?
I'm starting to figure that out.
This is like yeah. what I do.
Yeah,
man.
No, it was a thing, because it's one thing if you're talking to Ice Cube. It was a journey for him, though, too, because you remember, he did Boys in the Hood, and he was kind of, you know, the tough guy, mm-hmm. and, you know, playing a comedy, mm-hmm. to transitioning from, you know, The Nigga You Love to Hate, which was that album, mm-hmm. to a comedic straight guy. That was a bit of a journey for him. But
by the way, no rapper has done it since.
Hmm.
I want to make that very clear.
Wow.
When I say that, I'm saying you can arguably say Snoop has partaken in the conversation of gangster rap and merging it with personality performances or character
sure.
performances. But there's never been a lead where Snoop has been responsible for driving a story comedically.
Right.
Ice Cube has done it time after time again, and he's never compromised the integrity of the thing that you all believe
mm-hmm.
and have known him to.
Right.
Since then, it's a fear and a hesitation of most, right? LL Cool J, he went to TV, and he's done a TV show for a lot of years, but it's never really been a compromise of the LL Cool J that we've all known
right.
and that we've loved. So
right.
people going the complete opposite and being able to go back and forth, you don't see many do it at the highest level.
Right.
So to your point of saying like it was tough for Cube at first, I can get it. I can understand it.
Right.
I'm more concerned though you, and you're going, okay, fuck, how do I say what I think you should do and like not say it wrong? Because you don't have that experience at a high level now.
No. Everybody was afraid of Cube at the time in terms of just his persona and rap. And so you have Chris Tucker, who's just a comedian, who's like bullying him into smoking weed.
Yeah.
And so you just don't expect the skinny guy to bully Ice Cube, but that was the role, and they played it well. With Set It Off, the reason why I say awful is because I just didn't have... I wasn't articulate enough just in the game of making movies to get the type of performances that I got. Mm-hmm. And so I remember one particular moment that I look back and I was like, I was wrong for that. I remember needing a really dramatic moment from Jada Pinkett.
Mm-hmm.
She just went through something really dramatic. And I said, I needed to cry. And I got a clamshell, which is like this, the equivalent of like a video screen and videotape. And I went to her and I said, I want you to do this. I showed her Denzel Washington in Glory, where he's getting his ass whooped. And then he does this tear thing. And I'm like, I want you to do this. It's the worst way to direct.
Yeah.
If you know, thank you. He's like, what?
Yeah.
Exactly what? I'm a 26-year-old kid that knows what I want, but I just don't know how to articulate. I know what I need, but you learn over time when you work with legends and you study and you audit acting classes. Again, it's just, you know, when you don't have that film school thing, you're good at certain things, you're not good at others, and set it off. I learned a lot. They were great. We got probably one of the most emotional performances that I've created in Latifah.
Absolutely.
And so there was a rawness to it that I love. I love the outcome, but I think the process, I could have been a little better.
Well, the dope thing about you even speaking on that, right, is to be aware. To be aware is golden. To not be aware is the worst shit ever, right? Like, to actually understand where you were flawed.
Yeah.
Once again, we're going back to the purpose behind the podcast. It's to give you information, to give you gems. And sometimes the best way to correct the flaws are to operate in a manner of just not being aware as to where they exist. Because when you do the shit wrong, sometimes it comes out right, and then you get better for the next opportunity, and you're slowly learning about the world that you just jumped into. And everybody's perception sometimes from the outside is that it happens so fast. The director's talent is just as important as the actors and actresses, because how you build that relationship from day one to the wrap with your talent, how you guys build a trust in one another, it's all about this. It's all about the yin and yang. And the guy that I worked with on Lift, which we will get into, our rapport from day one as to, hey, man, I'm not here to be the big star. I'm operating under your control. You got that. I got no desire to operate in a space of control. I don't want to tell you shit. I want to support your shit. I set the tone from the top. So, granted, there were times where F, you know, where I was like, all right, F, goddamn. Kev, I need that again. That was ass. But we got comfortable enough where he could say, that was shit. That's ass. Kev, come on, you got better than that. Go, give me a second. Take a deep breath. Take two. We're going to come back, but I need you. Like, it's not where it's supposed to be. And that honesty, that transparency, put us in a place where we know when we rap, oh, we got some shit in there.
Yeah.
We got some shit in there. But getting to that place, well, that's a road. That's a journey. Now, I want to skip now, and I want to go to the Italian Job.
Okay.
Here's why I want to go to the Italian Job.
Sure.
At this point, you've proven yourself just in being able to handle and manage on behalf of casts with bulk. You got casts that have 5-6 characters. Set It Off had a fresh 4 that you had to tell the stories on behalf of, with a man whose story was important and coming from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
You had one with the turmoil of what am I going to do, the family. You had one that had the girlfriend and Queen Latifah. There were so many components that you had to tie in. But as a director, you showed that you can track that. Italian Job comes up. You got the time to work with Mark Wahlberg. You had
Jason Statham, Seth Green, Mos Def, Donald Sutherland.
Who was that girl? Was it Charlize Theron? Charlize Theron, right?
Exactly.
I mean, you're now, well, you done jumped.
Yes.
Right? This is a big jump. Like, there's a lot of credibility, and there's a lot of goddamn weight movement in this particular group.
Yes.
Now let's go to the conversation of, how did you approach that one? All right, well, I got out of this one. I got out of that one. But now, you know, I'm moving up. This is a much bigger budget.
Much bigger.
Much bigger budget.
Yes.
I mean, and you're now shooting on a location.
Yes.
Yes, you're now.
I'm global.
Yes, you're out of the comfort zone of the U.S. We going over here.
That's true.
Now, how are you approaching this opportunity? Because, well, it just keeps growing. It's not getting smaller. It's getting bigger.
Yeah.
What's the world of your mind at this point, taking on this project?
Well, I made The Negotiator, which was a step up from Set It Off.
What was Negotiator?
That was
15 was the budget. Budget for Negotiator.
I don't remember.
Okay.
But it was much bigger than Set It Off. And I remember getting a call from the head of Paramount at the time, Sherry Lansing, and they wanted me to come in and pitch an idea for this new heist movie.
How are you taking these calls when you get them? Are your legs crossed? What are you doing? What's the level? Because right now, you know, I know how I take calls. Like now.
That's now, how Kevin you take Hart them
today,
now.
This is no. how I take calls today. What today. Would you want to talk about? That's how, Kev, I'm going to talk to you about what? I ain't got the time. What you want to talk about? I want to pitch you something. You got 20 seconds.
Oh,
that's my
God.
Thing, right? I got demands.
Oh, my God.
I got demands now. You got 20 seconds. And if I don't get in the 20 seconds, you got to get the fuck out. That's how I talk to these people. So how are you taking these calls, F? What are you saying at the time? You on the head? You on the phone with the head of the studio?
Yeah. This is how it is to work with him, by the way. He has me crying. So funny. I took the call, and they said, we have, we have this movie,
mm-hmm.
and we want you to come in. And I think they gave me a day to prepare.
Wow. Prepare what your overview, your visuals, your breakdown, what you would do to make this movie special. You got a
yeah,
day.
Presentation.
Okay.
And remember, a day is not a lot of time.
No.
When you're prepping to do an $80 million movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Look at the jump. For my listeners, look at the jump. Look where we started off. We started off shooting his own movie. We didn't even discuss that budget, but I'm going to assume that budget probably was like 50 grand. What was it? What was your...
The short film?
What you were putting together, the short film?
$6,000.
$6,000. I jumped. I'm looking at it. I jumped out the window. I don't know why. Right? My perception of money has changed over the course of these years. I just want to say I apologize, and I understand that it's $6,000. But we went from $6,000, we went from $1 million, we went to $9 million. Negotiator is TBD, but I'm going to assume anything in that 20 to 30. Okay, you're going to go 40. All right, so now we're at 80. We're approaching that 100 number of responsibility. Yes. By the way, at this time, you're talking about the biggest bets that studios are taking. You're talking about a black director, right? And I got to make sure I say this in the most commercial way that I possibly can, right? Because I like the conversation attached to we need more, we want to see more, but I also never want to minimize the opportunities that one has created and made that openly have opened the door for others to come through. At this point, the conversation of men of color behind the lens operating with budgets is such, it's not a conversation that's happening often. This is a very big fucking deal. Not just for the studio, but for him. If he fucks this up, director jail is where they go. Director jail is real.
That's
I actually
true.
Have some directors That's that I've true. Bailed out as of late from director jail that are some of my closest friends, but it's real. So I know what that pressure is to date, but looking back on it, I mean, how are you? Hey, you got a day to prepare. You come up with this presentation.
Yeah.
Knock it out the park, obviously.
Well, it was a different process because it's the equivalent of auditioning.
Yeah.
So they had five other guys that they were going to meet with as well. And so you know you're on this list. And like you said, there are not a lot of brothers on that list for budgets this big because I don't think anyone up to that point had made a budget that big.
This is a big moment.
Yeah.
It's also a moment where if we want to say anything to those directors that you beat out, this is a perfect time to. If you want to snap and say, gotcha, bitch, anything. If you want to say anything like that. I can create this in the edit and it'll be really good.
No comment.
Okay.
No comment.
Gotcha. You're right. Let's stay away from that. All right. Let's stay away from that. Okay. So this is the audition. Like you said,
it's the audition. Mm-hmm. And I said, the one thing that you have to do in an audition process, as you know, is stand out and show that you're passionate, because there's a lot of money involved. There's a lot of people's jobs are on the line. They're not looking to do you, you know, any favors. They want to make sure they're going to make something that's going to get a return on investment, and it's going to be creative, and that can attract the cast. And so I remember going in and showing this digital presentation of the Mini Coopers racing through the streets of New York. And I said, you know, this is what you'll get. I put together a digital presentation, and the Mini Coopers, it was the new version of Mini Coopers. So to have a new design of the Mini Coopers in 3D, wow, racing through the streets of New York in 24 hours,
wow,
they were blown away. They're like, it would normally take you months,
yeah,
because the technology just didn't exist. And they were just kind of marveled at how I was able to put together a presentation of their movie in 24 hours.
Mm.
And how I did that was, it's kind of goes back to the hustle thing. I took a clamshell, I plugged in a PlayStation, I got the Gran Turismo video game, and I picked the Mini Coopers, and I recorded racing through the streets of New York. And then I sent it to an editor, put titles on it, put the Italian Job, and pretended like I did a full-on presentation of their movie.
This is also a good time. I want you guys to understand, F is he's the highest level of a nerd. Like, listen, I want you guys to understand, like, he is the highest, like, when it comes to this technology,
yeah,
and it comes to the idea of the new and the systems that are here current,
like
his love is in aviation, the yes, simulator he has that he fly. He is the highest level. Like, I've never seen anybody geek out more on visuals, technologies, and how I'm going to see it.
Yes.
Like, you got to think, everything is in the director's head. So you can never, like, act like you don't see what they see. Like, 80% of the time, I didn't know what the fuck he was looking at. He would close his eyes and go, this is how the plane's going to go. And then we're going to come in like this, and we're going to land. But there's not here. So you're going to be here. And this world, when it comes together, over here is where that door opens, and then we'll see it. And he opened up his eyes. I'm like, hell yeah. Like, hell yeah, I see it. So you give them the visual. They buy into it. You get the job. Now
yes,
you're working with the bigger level of talent going into it.
No.
Okay, give it to me.
This is 2003, something like that.
Okay.
So Wahlberg wasn't a big star at the time.
Okay.
Nor was Jason Statham. He had just come off Snatch.
Okay.
He wasn't a big, you know, movie star.
Mm-hmm.
Seth Green had a little traction in television. Mos Def was in music. And Charlize, she hadn't won an Oscar yet.
Mm-hmm.
These are all big stars now.
Yeah.
At the time, they were growing as talent. Now, of course, they had, you know, they're popular, but not as popular as they are now. And so I was lucky enough to get the cast that I wanted, work with a legend in, not only like Vincent D'Onofrio in Lift, but working with Donald Sutherland. And he worked with one of my favorite directors, Federico Fellini,
mm-hmm,
this Italian director who is just absolutely amazing. And so you brought it up earlier of being able to kind of take the production on the road and go to Venice, Italy, and shoot there and shoot in the Dolomites in the Italian Alps. And that's a whole nother process,
mm-hmm,
because now you're dealing with crews that come from 10 different countries. So I remember we were in the Italian Alps, and I walk out of the trailer, and I have multiple ADs who speak different languages to communicate and execute the vision, but to communicate to the crew in different languages. And it was 30 below zero, and I come out in this spacesuit and a mask, and I'm waddling over to the crew. And then I pulled down my mask and I start talking, and they're looking at me like, damn, it's a black dude. And it's, you know, it's, at the time, you just wouldn't see this massive crew in Europe, and you know, black face in the chair, you know, black director, in that environment. And so I'm, you know, kind of barking out all these orders to my ADs who spoke different languages, and they would communicate in different languages to the different parts of the crew to execute what we're trying to do. And so it was a completely different experience. But it was phenomenal to take it on the road. And that's part of the learning part of it. I love to learn. So with the technology, I learn. With the stunts, I learn. But also when you're traveling, you learn about different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one thing to grow up in the hood on the block. It's a whole nother thing where you're in a village in Austria and or in Italy. And that, again, nourishes just me as a person, mm-hmm. and as a creative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I love just the direction that we're taking this conversation in. And I mean, you know, we could talk all day about the success behind the movies that you've done and how those opportunities came. But I want to just make note that they're building, right? They constantly build.
Mm-hmm.
Now I want to get to Lyft.
Sure.
Now, right. And, all right. You know, and getting to Lyft, what I want to go back to, which is what I said earlier, you know, there were commitments that you and I made early on. And one of the commitments that you were standing on is that you want to make this movie different and special for me. You want to be able to show me through a different lens with a different performance.
Right.
Leading man, you want to put a stamp on what you feel the perception attached to Kevin Hart in a action thriller storytelling component. Here's what it should be. Right. Here's what I was able to pull out. And literally, like, from day one to what you're talking about is like interviewing. I remember you came over with just how you saw the movie taking its shape, where you saw it playing, how you saw the action breaking down. There was just a high level of energy put into the work before the work.
Right.
You approached it with the mindset of, I'm going to do a bunch of work here so everybody can understand how committed I am. Because when I'm in, I'm in. There is no hypothetical. When I say I'm 100%, that's what you're getting from me, 100%.
Right.
You stepped on that set every single day with the same attitude and the same want.
Mm-hmm.
My question to you is, what was your defining moment through the process of filming Lyft of understanding that, okay, the light bulb, we got something special here? When did it click? Like, I know there's a duration of shooting, and I know now we've seen our movie in full. And
sure.
I know that there's an editing process that you go through. Right. But while doing it, was there or when was there a moment where you said, oh, we got some good shit here? Because, of course, on the paper, it can be whatever we want. But
sure.
Once you see all the actors and actresses come together, there has to be some type of moment of realization. For you, what was it?
The moment of realization, I think that happens at different points in the process. I don't know if it happens squarely when you're shooting. But I do think that there were a couple moments when you settled into the character, because you were making, I think, probably the biggest transition,
mm-hmm.
out of everyone. And I if I could take you back just a little bit, I remember getting a call from Brian Smiley, the president of your company, and he kept calling, and I was just like, yeah, I'm not sure. But he was like, brother, what's going on? Like, what's happening? You know, this is Kevin. I'm like, okay, let me take a look at this. But I called Tim Story, because I wasn't sure at first, and I said, I heard a lot about Kevin. I heard he was a great guy. He's amazing to work with. Is all this true? He's like, it's all true. He's amazing to work with. He's the nicest guy. And I said, okay, because I've dealt with some challenging movies.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say that. And he wants to make this transition, and we really want you to be a part of this. So I had, the script wasn't perfect. And I looked at the script and I had a lot of notes. And you said, hey, listen, I came in prepared. I actually came in prepared for you guys to say, no, we don't want him because he wants change too much.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember coming in and saying, if I do this movie, and I love aviation, like you said, I'm a student pilot. I love to fly planes. I have a simulator at home. And so there was something that I loved about that, but I loved even more you making this transition and being a part of that. So when I sat, when I came to your home and met with you, all of it was true. You're very, very kind, very enthusiastic, very passionate about making this transition. And when I showed you what I would do with what I read, you were like, I'm on board, let's go. And so then we had the Zoom with Kira Goldberg and Simon Kinberg and the producers and everyone involved. And I said, here are my notes. And I think I had about 10 pages of notes. Are you guys okay with this? And they're like, yep, we're good. Let's do it. And so everybody agreed on the vision, and then we moved forward. And that's kind of part of my thing. It's like, can I make this my own?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When I thought that this would be something that we could be proud of is, I think, when we pulled together the cast.
Okay.
Because that was super hard. You know, casting during COVID, when you're looking at laptops and auditions on laptops and stuff like that, it's very, very rough. When we pulled the cast together, I knew that we were going to massage the script throughout the entire process. But with this cast, with D'Onofrio, Gugu was my first choice.
Gugu was amazing in this project.
Gugu, it was my first choice. And Billy Magnuson.
Billy's amazing.
And again, the legend and Vincent D'Onofrio.
Amazing.
The cast is really what solidified it. I knew I could put anything in front of them and they'd make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had different, you know, triumphs throughout the process of shooting. But I think you settling in to this character where we know how much talent you have. We know you can come in and burn down a room. But I also know how generous you are. And so you don't have to, like, tear the room down when you're in a room full of thespians.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You were giving. And we know what Kevin can do. Mm-hmm. But Kevin came and did his leading man thing. And it was something I was really proud of. It's something I was proud to be a part of, because another one of my motivations to do this movie is you normally see, even the old school movies with like Steve McQueen or George Clooney or, you know, Pierce Brosnan playing these roles, the mastermind in a heist movie. And I was like, Kevin is a mastermind in real life.
Mm-hmm.
Don't sleep on the comedy. He's building an empire, mm-hmm, with all these different businesses and all these different things. And I said, I want to take what I know about you and put that on the screen, because I think it would be inspiring. And so all of those things is what kind of add up to why I felt like this movie would work.
You know, it's crazy that you say it, because in the process of us executing it, there was an extreme amount of alignment, not just between you and myself, the cast, the studio, right? I mean, you know, I think Netflix were unbelievable partners through this process.
Absolutely.
Because there's no process that presents itself to be easy, right? And you need some turbulence, pun intended. With the movie Lift. Without it, then, you know, it's nothing to prove that we care about and that we want to make right. And I think, you know, from Kara to the rest of the team, just being a part of all of the important conversations and showing that we all are invested into the same thing and we want the same return out of it,
right,
which is a good movie. And more importantly, a movie that will be pivotal for my next moves in my career. I can't wait for the audience to just see me take on a role of this magnitude and give a performance that's not just real grounded, believable, but one of substance because of my surroundings, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a story that I feel everybody's going to respond to. And the visuals attached to the movie are some of the biggest that I've been a part of. And remember, like, I've done some big movies, right? Like, you know, I was in Jumanji. That shit there, we had animals that never were on set that appeared in the film. I'm like, well, where did that come from? How did,
right,
we create that shit?
And sure,
there's a lot of things that go into that. But as far as the visuals from an action perspective and how you were able to execute from our fight scenes to just our background,
mm-hmm,
the drop, you know, I mean, literally, I've never been a part of a project as big. Sure. And, dude, I got to thank you. I got to thank you from the bottom of my heart for not only taking on a project, but believing that I would do exactly what I said I would do. Because ultimately, we're gambling.
Right.
We're gambling by saying, I'm going to take your word for it, and I'm going to show up to a 75-day shoot expecting you to give me your all every day so that I can know that I got what I need. It's a gamble.
Right? Yes.
I thank you for believing my words, and I thank you for executing on yours. And I think that together, we now have something that we can sit back and look at and act as historic moments for the both of us. We've never worked together.
Right.
We discovered that we're damn near birthday twins. We share the same sign.
That's right.
We got the same likes, the same dislikes.
Right.
Our patience level is the same, and when we pop versus when we don't. There's so many similarities. And there's now a friendship attached to the bond.
Right.
That's not just work.
That's correct.
And that's very hard to do in the business that we're in.
It is, and I'll speak to that. I called Kevin up on, or actually texted him on Thanksgiving. I'm like, happy Thanksgiving. He's like, bro, what are you doing? You want to come over? You have somewhere to eat? You need a plate? And it was funny because I'm like, he thinks I have nowhere to go.
Yeah.
But I wasn't asking for a place to eat. But he immediately went to come over to my house and come have dinner with us. And I went to go see my mom and stuff like that. But I did go to his house.
Stop by.
I just stopped by just to say hello,
yeah.
And saw the whole setup and everything. And so I did describe you and working with you as like working with your favorite cousin that has your back. You know, when you get in trouble, like you call your favorite cousin. It's like it's time to get down. Like we shoulder to shoulder, and we made that happen.
Yeah.
And it was a real great process in working with you as a partner, because the one thing I think you got maybe a little wrong is my patient. People know I wear it on my face, and I got to work on that.
Yeah.
You know how to.
I can hide it.
You can hide it.
Yeah. I can hide it.
You can hide it. But I remember getting a couple calls like, you know, people can see your face,
yeah,
right?
I'm telling you,
right,
that.
Right, right.
That's you got to work on.
Yeah, you got to work on that.
It's
Gene,
really strong.
Because if I'm disappointed, <It's> like, I'll give the what the fuck was that look. But I don't know that. I don't see it.
Yeah.
He saw it, but he's real gracious about it. Like, hey.
Come here, Lev. Come over. Get a cup of coffee with me real quick.
Come
hey,
on,
man,
bro.
You got to stop it was the goddamn straight.
Hey, listen. I'll say this. You're very gracious in the process. Netflix was gracious as well because, you know, what people will forget is that we made this movie during COVID.
Yeah.
And that's something that's very new to all filmmakers. Making that, you know, the challenges of making a movie where, you know, the cast and the crew are falling left and right from COVID. We have to rewrite the script on the fly. We have to wear masks. It slows down the process. Every single country we shot in, because we shot in Belfast, Ireland, and London, England, and Trieste, Italy, and Venice, Italy. Everyone had different rules for us to land in their country. So mm-hmm. COVID rules were different. And so some of us missed planes because of like visas and COVID vaccine things. And you'll never see that or feel that in the movie, but it was an extreme challenge to make this movie. And you always had a great attitude about it. The other thing that people will never know is just three countries over, they started a war.
Yeah.
So in Ukraine, they're testing ICBM nuclear missiles, mm-hmm. and we're nervous because London is a place where we're shooting, and on the news they're like, well, London would be the first place they strike if they're going to do a nuclear attack. And so now you have, you know, a Kevin Hart movie, and you're trying to have all this great energy, and you always brought the great energy, but we're on the extreme. We made the movie under extreme circumstances.
Yes.
It's pretty intense, but you are always balanced.
Try my best to remove all of that stuff from our set. Remove the idea of what's
yeah.
happening there that we can't control into the idea of what we can.
But I think it's worth mentioning, though, because, you know, under normal circumstances, you know, you can deliver this or that, but under extreme circumstances, when you deliver, I think people should get credit for that, and you guys did a great job.
Well, thank you, man. I find a lot of comfort in discomfort, which is weird, but it's the truth. You know, when you're too comfortable, it's a feeling that I'm not best being comfortable with. When there is a little bit of, oh shit, whoa, gotta make this happen. Mm. There's a different energy attached to that. So I like operating in that regard.
That's some Navy SEAL shit.
Well, I mean, I'm definitely, you know, I couldn't operate in that shit. That's too much discomfort. They blowing shit up? Oh shit! Wait! Oh god, we lost the boat.
I don't know.
Oh shit! Oh god! Wait, they blew up the room with the weapons. Oh shit! Yeah, that's too much.
I think you play too much, bro. Yeah, yeah. People. Kevin has hands, and Kevin is trained. Kevin, I know that. You throw that
yeah,
shit out
there.
Yeah,
I get you off me. But, yeah. I get you up off me.
Yeah. Don't sleep on
afterwards,
Kevin.
Afterwards, I'm running. I'm haul ass and afterwards. Bop, bop. Get the fuck out of here. Go. Go. I hope what people take away from this conversation is the progression. There was an amazing build that you got to hear, and a breakdown that's attached to the energy that this man has, the energy that he brings, and the passion that he attaches his craft with. That's not earned. I mean, that's not given. It's earned, right? People develop that over a course of time. And the things that you end up working on the most are things that you're learning from that you can go and look back and simply correct on your own. Sometimes you don't need to be told what you're not doing or what you need to do or what else has to happen. Sometimes you can see it yourself. And when you see it yourself, you're your best teacher. You're your best teacher at providing yourself with an understanding for what the tools that will make the future better and brighter. Looking for the person to navigate, delegate, or tell you all the time. Sometimes it puts you in a position of wait. Create is a much better position. This is an example of creativity at a highest level. It's also an example of return. What you put into something, you ultimately will get out. And I got to be honest and say, it is an honor and a pleasure for me to be able to say that I have a F. Gary Gray movie under my belt in my career. That is a very big conversation for me.
Thank you.
And for those listening, if you're not educated on F. Gary Gray, please do me a favor and go educate yourself. Go look at his work. Look at where it started. Look at the world of videos that he's come from. Look at the beginning and look at the now. $2 billion in box office revenue is nothing to be frowned upon or overlooked. He's a part of a conversation that few are, and that conversation is not ending. The scary part is he's still doing more and wants to do more. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Gold Mines. You know what we do here. We get inside the minds of amazing individuals. And today was no different. January 12th, mark your calendars. And today, mark the moment. This is Gold Mines. Please, one more time, give F. Gary Gray some love properly, guys. What an amazing guest. F, thank you, brother. Thank I appreciate you, for coming on, man. This is exactly what it's supposed to be. Goddamn it, Gold Mines. A lot of gems will drop. Do yourself a favor and pick them up. Put them in your back pocket. Save them for later and pick up one in the time of need. I'm Kevin Hart, and I'll see you next time. Peace.
Gold Mines with Kevin Hart is a Sirius XM and Laugh Out Loud radio production. Executive produced by Kevin Hart, Ty Randolph, Mike Stein, Brian Smiley, Eric Eddings, and Eric Weil. Produced by Danny Sellers and Leslie Guam, and engineered by Danny Sellers.